cool, a high of 59. Rain rolling through the area now, 52 degrees Racine, 51 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And it is 10 minutes after 8 o'clock here on WGTD, having a little trouble playing our theme, so we will get to the morning show in just a second. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Who would have thought that there could be a fascinating story behind something as common as the simple peanut? In fact, the story of the peanut is not a simple one, and in particular, there is a facet to the story of the peanut that intersects with the very troubling legacy of slavery. And that is what is explored in a really interesting new book called Slaves for Peanuts, a story of conquest, liberation, and a crop that changed history. It is the work of a journalist, an award-winning journalist by the name of Jory Lewis, who has written on an array of environmental topics and agricultural topics as well. She has done work, among others, for PRI, and her work has appeared in a number of different publications. And she has crafted this book, which in many ways is a very interesting outgrowth of her own personal history. And it is research that has not been easy by any means, because in many cases she is talking about the history of individuals who so often are swallowed up in complete obscurity. And it is remarkable what she has been able to find about some who hundreds of years ago toiled endlessly to help raise peanuts. And she also helps us understand why peanuts for a time were such an important and valuable crop, even beyond sort of the offhand casual way in which we tend to consume them as a snack. But they represented something far more precious than that, particularly at a certain point in time. All this and more is explored in this very interesting book, which is published by the New Press, again titled Slaves for Peanuts, A Story of Conquest, Liberation, and a Crop That Changed History. And Jory Lewis, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Glad we can have this conversation. So I touched briefly in my introduction on the matter of the personal. That is, there is a person in your own family tree, as it were, a distant ancestor who, in a sense, folds into this story of the peanut. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, I'm not exactly sure, but if I understand you correctly, of course, my my extended family, my father's family especially, we know quite a bit more about them. But of course, on both of sides of my family, there are enslaved people. My great-grandfather presumably grew peanuts on his farm in Arkansas. So I talk a little bit in my introduction about having this kind of relationship to the peanut, kind of relating it to our visits to Arkansas during the summers or the holidays. Hmm.
You live part of the year in Illinois and part of the year in the nation of Senegal. Explain your connection to that nation and exactly the nature of the work that you have done and continue to do there.
Well, I moved to Senegal about a decade ago with a kind of fellowship to write about sort of food policy, agriculture, and the environment in the region. And I just ended up staying on, just mostly continuing that beat of writing about the intersections of the environment and agriculture, especially. So, yeah, that's that's how it came about, sort of by chance that I ended up staying.
Tell us more, just a little bit about the nation of Senegal itself. What kind of a country is it?
Well, Senegal's a pretty small country in surface area. I always forget how we compare it. Usually, I think it's like about the size of South Dakota, a little bit smaller than South Dakota. Hmm. And it has about, I think it's now up to 16 million people, but I'll have to check. It's in between 15 and 17. So it's not a huge country, but it's kind of dense. And Senegal has some really strong traditions of literature and dance and music, and it's just a really welcoming, open country. I think Senegal is also the westernmost country in West Africa, in Africa in general, in continental Africa. And I think, especially from Dakar, you really get this sense of an orientation or an openness to the rest of the world. Mm.
Probably in part because of its geographical location on the African continent, in Senegal, we also see the history of the slave trade. Tell us more about that and the way in which Senegal understands this part of its own history.
Yeah, of course. It's an interesting question. The slave trade, of course, sort of predates the transatlantic trade. There had before that been a trans-Saharan trade, which I would imagine that Senegal also, or at least the territory we now call Senegal, like, was a part of. But once the sort of transatlantic slave trade, or sort of started in the 15th century, let's call it, you start to see more, starting with the Portuguese, and then other Southern European sailors who are sailing down the West African coast and exploring. They first come to areas in like Mauritania and Senegal because, of course, geographically they're closer to Europe, right? And so there's already a kind of relationship of somewhat of violence at first, then a kind of exchange. Senegal enters quite early into the transatlantic slave trade, but then falls off quite a bit, right? Because then the locus of the transatlantic slave trade moves south.
Hmm. So how much
answers your question?
Yes, absolutely. So how much do people in modern day Senegal talk about this history? Talk about, for instance, slavery, including people who live there now who are, for instance, the descendants of slaves. And is this a topic that is easily broached and openly discussed?
No, it's not really a topic that's so well discussed here. There are, of course, two different relationships. One is a relationship of Senegal to the transatlantic trade. And for that, there are a number of kind of public monuments or sites of memory, like Gorée Island, and there's a new sort of monument being built in Dakar. To sort of commemorate the transatlantic slave trade. But the conversation around slavery as it existed in Africa is almost never broached openly.
When was it, or under what circumstances, did you first learn of this intriguing connection between the raising of peanuts and slavery in West Africa? When did you first, in a sense, stumble upon the kind of the kernel of this story?
Well, I would say that, in some way, of course, I've always known, or maybe not always, but for some amount of time, I've known that slavery, of course, did exist in Africa. And for me, this is not, for some people, this is controversial, but for me, it's not, right? I, of course, Of course, there was some slavery in Africa. But when I first moved to Senegal and I was spending a lot of time in an area they call the Peanut Basin, which is a little bit, you know, maybe like 3 or 4 hours south of Dakar. And I remember going to a particular village and meeting some farmers there. And later, when I was speaking to a friend, my future ex-boyfriend, he was telling me that, they were forming a farming collective, but that this one particular man who I thought was really the best person to kind of lead the collective, and he also thought was the best person to lead the collective, was barred from leadership by the others because he was from a slave-descended family. And for me, that was such a surprising moment, even though, of course, I knew that slavery had existed, but to understand that it still had sort of fixed a stigma on this man and his family over the years was really mind-blowing for me. And I think that the rest of the investigation sort of must have started from that one point, this kind of looking into how that spread out for me in different directions.
We're speaking with journalist Jory Lewis about her new book, which is called Slaves for Peanuts, A Story of Conquest, Liberation, and a Crop That Changed History. I think before we go any further, I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk specifically about the peanut itself. You don't spend a lot of time, but I think you spend certainly sufficient time in your book kind of talking about, first of all, sort of what the peanut is, a little bit about how it's raised. And at one point you talk in the book about how the peanut is, in your words, a rarity in nature. So there's a lot to unpack there, but let's first begin with some basic information about the peanut, including the mystery surrounding where the peanut originated.
Where did the peanut originate? Yeah, the peanut is from South America. That's its center of origin. But for a long time, people didn't know where it came from, just because when it started to be kind of noticed on a wide scale, it was just kind of everywhere. So for a long time, there were all these, you know, huge scientific conversations about where is the center of origin of the peanut. So it's only been since, the last few decades that we've known definitively that the peanut originated in South America.
What about this matter that you say in your book that the peanut is a rarity in nature? I think it has something to do with the way it buries its own fruit in the ground. What is significant about that?
Yeah, the peanut is one of the... let me just look really quickly. I forgot how many. There are very few plants that grow in this way. So it's pretty distinct in terms of its cultivation, that it like flowers above ground and then buries its fruit inside the ground. I think that's basically the difference.
Interesting. So one of the things that your book outlines is the fact that the peanut was of interest to many Europeans, not just because it is something that can be eaten and utilized in the kitchen in a number of different ways, but also because of Europe's urgent need for more oils for a lot of different reasons that actually have nothing to do with food or the kitchen. Explain to our listeners about this urgent need for oil and why peanut oil ended up being a very valuable and attractive commodity at this point in time.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting parts of the book to research, just because it puts the peanut and its relationship in Africa in a kind of global context. and kind of looking at these super big global ships. So, you know, at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, there are a few things happening that lead to an explosive demand for oil. You know, some of it's oil to oil machines. Some of it is oil for like textile manufacturing. They need it for other types of machines. And then also this explosive demand for soap as people, which is also actually related to textiles in one way, but also related to changing mores about hygiene. So there's this sort of changed sense that people need to bathe, whereas before in previous centuries, like, bathing had kind of gone out of style or bathing so frequently. So yeah, it's an interesting sort of nugget of history, or that people were looking for oil for all these reasons, but like taking it from anywhere they could get it. And I think that gives you a kind of context even for, say, like whaling. You know, there's needed whale oil. They're out there killing these humongous mammals in the ocean just for oil.
Fascinating. So your book kind of takes up this story in primary fashion at a time when, at least in some places, slavery is being abolished. And one of the most interesting timelines that you share with us involves the French and the way in which slavery was abolished for a time and then allowed to be, in a sense, reinstated, at least in certain places, and then abolished all over again, and I think maybe more emphatically. And that's so interesting to explore, because I think most of us think of the whole history of slavery in much more sort of blunt, simplistic fashion, that there's a country that has allows slavery, and then at some point in time it decides, nope, we're not going to do that anymore, and then slavery is essentially eliminated from that point on. At least with the French, it's a much more complicated timeline than that. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the French did abolish slavery. Forgive me, I can't remember actually the actual date. Like in the late 1790s, it was in the 1790s. I don't know if it was the late ones. Sorry, let me just verify that.
I think 1790. I believe 1794, if my notes can be believed. I think I took that from your book.
That, we'll just say the 1790s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so they did this. It was an outcropping of the Haitian Revolution, and it's you know, the French ended up, you know, it's interesting. Of course, French history is itself just so full of so many twists and turns in this period, right? Like, the, you know, there's the French Revolution, and then, you know, what, two decades later, you know, there's an emperor, right? Like Napoleon. So there are these shifts happening in general in France, right? They're, you know, killing their monarchy and then establishing another type of monarchy after a really sort of completely different revolutionary government. And in the same way, although not exactly the same, the sort of slavery question comes up. So the French sort of abolished slavery because there are these revolutions happening in the Caribbean, you know, mostly, in fact, like enslaved people clamoring for their freedom. And it's a kind of like in run also around the meddling of other nations, right? Who have their eyes on the island of Haiti, Santo Domingo, right? So they free the slaves so that the enslaved can fight for them, right? So then after Napoleon comes to power, Napoleon's sort of not down with this like freed slave business, and he reinstates slavery, which is kind of bonkers, right? Of course, slavery wasn't you know, even in the original sort of decree, it wasn't abolished everywhere, but it was abolished in some places. So, and then later, some 40 years later, slavery's finally abolished on what they, you know, all French land. That's what the statute says. So that's in 1848, and that's in that's the abolition law that concerns Senegal or the parts of Senegal that are in fact French.
So it's so interesting to think and to look at the relationship between Europe and the African continent, and how at one point in time, certain colonial powers like France or Britain saw Africa, it would seem, as much as anything for a place in order to find slaves for themselves, and then at some point they begin to see Africa very differently as a place that has something of tremendous value to offer besides slaves, or in addition to slaves, or maybe even more than slaves. And one of those things would be something like the peanut and peanut oil, which apparently one did not find, at least in abundance, on the European continent. What kind of a difference did this make, and how did this happen, this kind of shift in attitude about how the European powers viewed Africa and its value to them?
Well, I guess I wouldn't say that it is an opposition. I think that even during the slave trade, the active transatlantic slave trade, slave ships were carrying more than just the enslaved people. They were carrying other types of goods, and those types of goods were often traded along with the enslaved, right? Sometimes within Africa itself. So maybe they were taking, I don't know. This is not scientific. I have no, but maybe they were taking like malagueta, which is like a pepper, from one place to another, or rice or something else from one place to another, and then getting something else, and then getting enslaved people. So the transatlantic trade was much more complex than I think we traditionally understand it to be. And the kind of relationship that Europe had of extraction, whether that be people or products, didn't really change over time. In fact, I would almost say that this, what I'm sort of putting my finger on, is actually a continuity in a way.
Mm. So it's not that the one, in a sense, displaced or lessened the other, and that they in fact worked in some sort of concert with each other.
I think so. Yeah, that they always had. So that when the sort of transatlantic trade sort of diminished, the others sort of picked up, but they were never kind of happening in isolation.
So tell us exactly the connection then between slavery and the raising of peanuts, what exactly that connection is that, in a sense, you were able to uncover and explore in a little more detail.
Yeah, so the relationship it's a little bit complicated. I like to explain that, of course, that during the transatlantic slave trade, and just in general, of course, there's always been slavery, that there is a kind of a mechanism that creates slaves, right? That is usually war, in which people were ransomed. So like during the transatlantic slave trade, that mechanism was really ticked up. They were really working hard on that. And but once the slave trade finished, the transatlantic slave trade stopped in 1807, 1808, and then progressively for other Europeans later, that mechanism whereby enslaved people were created didn't stop. It just looked for other markets, right? So then as there started to be a demand for the peanuts, this parts of Senegal and Guinea and Mali and all of these areas became kind of destinations for this labor that was out there. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
I hope that answers your question.
And because the demand was so acute, because there was such demand for the peanut, in a sense, there was then such demand for slaves to raise these peanuts.
Right. So there's some documentation just shows it's interesting. The documentation is never like these slaves are there only to grow peanuts, but we can infer that there's this demand for peanuts, and we see that there's an increase in the movement of enslaved people from the interior to these regions.
One of the points you make very early in the book is that when one is trying to explore the experience of people who were slaves, that is almost by definition going to be a tremendously difficult challenge. In your words, writing a historical narrative about the enslaved is complicated because there are multiple layers of silences. Explain what you mean by that, by multiple layers of silences, when we are talking about wanting to explore the experience of the enslaved.
Yeah, thanks for that question. It's, it was really important for me to try to include the voices of the enslaved as much as possible. And, you can be the judge of whether or not I succeeded, but it's difficult to do because archives, the tools that we use to tell history, so there's archives and maybe oral histories, neither one of those things tend to preserve the voices of people who aren't, important in a society. So it's difficult to bring out those stories of people who have been subjugated or an underclass just by the very nature of our record keeping of the archive and of the oral history, which is the oral history is one sort of tool you use to tell kind of, let's call them like hidden histories maybe. But in this case, most oral histories are also only talking about like the kings or like the religious leaders or whatever, but not talking about like the peasant and the enslaved.
One of the communities that you focus quite a lot of time on is a community that or region that at a glance looks like it's named St. Louis, because it is under the control of the French at the time. We should probably more properly call it Saint Louis, I suppose. But it's a very, very interesting city that is significant in the establishment of Senegal. And in particular, it plays a very important role when it comes to slaves and especially those wanting to escape slavery. Explain the significance of this city and why it looms so large in your book, Slaves for Peanuts.
Yeah, so Saint Louis, yeah, I do say it Saint Louis. It's even weird to say it Saint Louis. It's funny because I grew up in Springfield, Illinois, and it's an hour and a half from Saint Louis. But yes, this place is called Saint Louis. And Saint Louis was the capital of French West Africa in general, and for quite some time. And during the period that this book is happening, it's there's no such thing called French West Africa then, but it's the capital of the colony of Senegal. So all of the administrative things are there. So like the head of the church is there, the head of the governor is there, the army is based there, right? So, and it has this kind of, it has a kind of flourishing community of traders, of Senegalese traders, of mixed race bureaucrats and traders also. So it's just like a very vibrant, diverse community. And then, you know, after 1848, the French have their statute that says slavery must not exist on French land. And Saint-Louis is really one of the only places besides, a couple of other towns and forts. It's the only real place that's technically French land. So a lot of the book does take place there because I start to focus on this institution called the Mission for Runaway Slaves, and they're operating from Saint-Louis, perhaps for that reason, right? That it is supposed to be a place where there are no enslaved people.
Mm. One of the really interesting people who works there is a missionary by the name of Walter Taylor, who we get to meet and we get to know through the pages of your interesting book. Tell our listeners about the important role that he played, especially when it came to people who were hoping to escape the bonds of slavery.
Right. So Walter Taylor was a Protestant missionary, but he wasn't, I think, the type of missionary we typically think about, right? He was a black man from Sierra Leone, and his own background was that his parents had been freed from slave ships and settled in Freetown. So he had a personal sort of resonance with this idea of helping runaway slaves, and he eventually started a mission, a sort of shelter for runaway slaves in Saint-Louis under the auspices of this French Protestant Missionary Society.
You try to write honestly and thoroughly about the role that the Christian Church played in this colonial period, particularly in Africa, both Catholic and Protestant organizations. Although it's not easy to summarize, how would you summarize that presence? And is there good that was done amidst other things done that we would, of course, now with the hindsight of history, find to be quite objectionable?
How would I characterize the? Just to repeat for a second. Sorry,
In terms of the work of the church in Africa during this colonial period, did they accomplish any good? Because we do tend to think quite a lot about all of the ways in which they did things in the African continent that we would now see in rather objectionable terms.
Yeah, that's such a good question. You know, of course, they thought they were doing the right thing at the time, right? Which is forcing people to conform not only to this new religion, but to a new sort of set of social and cultural mores. It's quite mixed, right? Because of course the Protestant mission did do a lot of good for the people it was working with. They, you know, it helped them get jobs, it helped them get houses, it helped them get married, you know, even though that was one of their sort of key things, was, you know, getting people to get married. So I don't know if it's a help or like they were forcing them to get married. So gave them a kind of community in a place that could have been hostile to them. But at the same time, yeah, there's this sort of relationship to like assimilation and leaving a part of yourself and leaving a part of your traditional beliefs and certain customs and a kind of let's call it like paternalism that feels a little bit icky from the distance of, you know, 150 years.
Absolutely. What about the relationship between, let's call them colonizers from Europe and local officials in Africa, in some cases, even kings or damels? I was not prepared until I read your book for how complicated those relationships would often be. Did you find that to be true as well as you explored this?
How complicated the relationships between the leadership in these places and the colonial government?
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
You know, I think we don't really in America, and maybe many other places, I don't know, don't have enough of a sort of grounding in sort of like African history and maybe like African traditions. So for me, one sort of actually truly pleasurable part of doing this work was like uncovering and sharing this really, these really complicated, interesting societies and they're like internecine conflicts that feel like they're straight out of, you know, a tale about like the, you know, about the Medicis or something, you know. So there's all this sort of like backstabbing and like, you know, court lies, and there's just so much that's high drama practically. So that's already sort of happening, and I think that the relationship between like the French when they come adds another sort of layer of like internal jockeying for influence and power. It becomes like the French, in a way, I think from their perspective, from like the local leader, from a damel or from the other people who may well want to be who may want to be king or have influence, I think they saw the French as a kind of tool that they could use to gain more power. And I think it blows up in their faces, obviously. So
yeah.
That's the other flip side.
One especially fascinating story is of how fervently the French wanted to construct railroads in West Africa in order to, of course, facilitate the transport of goods. And this is a long and difficult process, and it is also a prospect that is mightily resisted by local officials. Tell us more about this story, about why the specter of a railroad was so distasteful, and then what ultimately happened.
Well, I think that at the time, you know, the French were also building railroads in France, right? Like, there's a big sort of infrastructure push in France at the time. And, you know, even just before the period I'm talking about in this book, in America, we just built our first transcontinental railroad. So there's a kind of association with the building of railroads to, like, I think they even maybe explicitly make this comparison, at least some thinkers of the day, to America, this idea of subduing the interior, this like vast interior of a country, but by, you know, in America, it's, you know, a country, but a whole continent by building a railroad. So it could try to dominate it by being able to move goods and people faster across long distances. So in Senegal, in Cajour, the Damel Latour initially refuses to greenlight this railroad, seeing that, I think he must have seen that it was, you know, a losing game for him, right? Like, it's no good if, like, the French can just move their people so fast across his country, but he ends up losing out.
There are a lot of stories that are told here that, in a sense, resolve in ways not fully anticipated. I think we need to leave it to our listeners to explore more on their own, but I do want to be sure to ask you about the kinds of resources to which you turned in order to tell this story so thoroughly. Because as we touched on a little bit earlier when we were talking about trying to write about or research the experience of the enslaved, often there is kind of a gaping void where one wants so much to find information. You actually were able to draw upon a very valuable wellspring of information in order to tell some of this story so well. Explain, I think it was especially letters and papers that were of special value to you in trying to tell this story.
Yeah, my goal in writing this book, because, you know, I'm not an academic, and I wanted to write a book that was engaging, that had like a narrative flow, so that we could bring the voices of people sort of directly to the reader. And so, yeah, I used as much as possible letters from both Protestant missions archives, which are in Paris, and that's where I found some about 20 years of correspondence from Walter Taylor, the Protestant missionary. But I also used quite extensively the Senegalese National Archives, which had letters, like first, you know, letters from Lajor, for instance. And occasionally I use like court documents. There's, I think, a whole chapter that's drawn from what's essentially like a court document that, you know, takes the testimony of the enslaved. So I used whatever I could, you know, to try to build this story.
Well, you've done a remarkable job, and the result is a really, really fascinating story that, in a sense, whets our appetite to want to know still more about this fascinating and troubling period. And of course, your book takes us beyond what we think of as the primary colonial period, takes us all the way into the early 20th century. And it's quite a fascinating book, start to finish. Again, it's titled Slaves for Peanuts, a story of conquest, liberation, and a crop that changed history. The book is published by The New Press, the author, Jory Lewis. Jory Lewis, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about your very interesting book. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And to finish out today's morning show, I thought it would be interesting if I read for you the preface to Jory Lewis's book, Slaves for Peanuts. Jory Lewis writes, "I had never seen a peanut grow until I went to Senegal. I'm told that Papa Lewis, my great-grandfather, had grown peanuts on his Arkansas farm, along with okra and corn, soybeans and cotton, but he died long before I was born. His son, my grandfather's elder brother, must have predicted what was coming for American agriculture early on, and pulled out his mixed cropping system to focus on soy and cattle alone. I still associate peanuts with that Arkansas family, though, because I remember always coming back from our vacations there with bags of freshly roasted peanuts nestled in their tan shells, but I guess we bought them at someone else's farm stand. Peanut snacking was a regular occupation as we drove the 7 or 8 hours back to Illinois, cracking open the shells to pop the peanuts into our mouths. Sometimes I would suck on the shells for extra salt, while I stared out the window, watching the topography change from the rice fields that sat low along the rivers to the spiky hills of the Ozarks, half forest and half rock, and finally back to the flat landscapes I knew best, a glance at the horizon yielding unvarying glimpses of lonely farmhouses in the middle of fields of corn whose stalks had grown twice as tall as any man. Those flat vistas from my childhood always flashed through my mind on my trips through Senegal's main agricultural zones, where plots of millet and peanuts occupy a procession of fields broken up only by a tree here or there, or a parade of wandering cows. It was in one such field that I first espied
the peanut's tiny flowers, the color of sunshine, and so similar in shade and size, if not in form, to the buttercups I used to pick in our yard as a child. Nothing else was familiar, though. Not the horse-drawn plows, not the sight of people bending to harvest peanuts by hand, not the work songs of the men who came from Guinea-Bissau to separate the stems and leaves from the shells, not the great mound of peanuts outside the peanut oil factory, piled so high it could block out the sun. I had been interested in how something as humble as the peanut had acted as the motor of the Senegal's economy for so long. For more than a century, this small country had been one of the top producers of the oily legume in the world. It was only an offhand comment by a future ex-boyfriend, an agronomist, that pushed me down a slightly different path. One day he was telling me about one of the villages where he worked, where the farmers were organizing a collective. They had decided to exclude a smart and capable man from a leadership position, a man I had met on trips to the region who was the person objectively most qualified for the job. They had excluded him because he was known to be descended from people who had once been enslaved. I flinched when I heard this. As a descendant of the enslaved myself, I found it both painful to hear about this discrimination and difficult to understand. In trying to make sense of this, in trying to understand the reasons and justifications, I started to search for other descendants of slavery, both in those peanut lands and in regions farther afield, in mud houses in the village, in reed-lined fields that hug the river, and in high-rise apartments in Dakar. Eventually, my search and attempt to find out more led me to a series of historical records. I would have liked to say that I was able to resurrect the voices of those who had been enslaved. But writing a historical narrative about the enslaved is complicated because there are multiple layers of silences. There is the fundamental silencing of indigenous voices in the colonial archives, which privilege those of European officials. And many of the available epic poems or oral histories that have been passed from generation to generation often tell the stories of society's elites, the kings, nobles, warriors, and important religious leaders. Women rarely feature, and the enslaved almost never. They are muted. And the distance of a century reveals only flickering spectral forms. How do we tell the stories of people that history forgets and the present avoids? I have tried here to uncover a handful of stories about a handful of people. I wish I could have done more. This was the preface to Jory Lewis's fascinating book, Slaves for Peanuts, a story of conquest, liberation, and a crop that changed history, published by the New Press. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program, and joining her will be Brandon Corder, who is working with the Cameron Lab of Botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is an expert on mosses. And on Friday, we look forward to a return visit to The Morning Show from Trevor Young,
who is transit manager for the city of Racine. He has helped to oversee the conversion of part of Racine's fleet of city buses into electric vehicles.